We're coming up on the silly season, when the presumption is that you're at the beach or taking it easy in the dog days of summer, or at least trying to beat the heat. It's the season of frivolous news, assuming there aren't more terrorist attacks or shootings of police or shootings by police or coup attempts. Let's just assume, let's just hope, that we'll have a few weeks where we can have a silly season. So, here's my contribution.
Now there's no one that we're certain the Kremlin doesn't touch. We think that Westbrook Pegler doth protest a bit too much. We only hail the hero from whom we got our name.
We're not sure what he did,
but he's our hero just the same. Oh, we're the John Birch Society, the John Birch Society.
This song is by the Chad Mitchell Trio, recorded in 1962. It's about the John Birch Society, a real anti-communist, reds-under-the-beds kind of group. When it was first formed in the late 1950s, it saw commie threats everywhere. President Eisenhower, a dedicated conscious agent of communist conspiracy. That's a direct quote. Fluoride in drinking water, a Soviet mind control plot. The John Birchers even called Nelson Mandela a communist terrorist thug.
You cannot trust your neighbors or even next of kin. If mommy is a commie, then you gotta turn her in. Oh, we're the John Birch Society, the John Birch Society, fighting for the right to fight, the right fight for the right. Join the John Birch Society as we're marching on.
So, who were these guys? Who was John Birch? And why should you care? Because our focus this time around is on conspiracy theories, often silly, but sometimes with consequences that are all too serious. This is Whose Century Is It?, a podcast about ideas, trends, and twists shaping the 21st century. I'm Mary Kay Magstead. So, conspiracy theories. A great midsummer topic when you're making fun of them. Less so when the conspiracy theories are, say, popping up at national conventions and threatening to change the course of a nation's political life. Conspiracy theories of whatever stripe tend to have a few things in common.
I think that conspiracy theories are the product of a mistrust or distrust of power.
This is Terry Louts. More about him in a moment.
Conspiracy theories lend themselves to an alternate view of reality. Conspiracy theories cannot be disproved easily. They develop a life of their own, and once they're born, they seem never to die.
Like the conspiracy theories around the Kennedy assassination, or Benghazi, or 9/11, or whether astronauts actually landed on the moon. And then, of course, there are the great power conspiracy theories, competitors and rivals sure that the other is playing dirty to do them down. There was plenty of that going around during the Cold War, and these days there's a new wave between China and the United States, with some conspiracy theories coming from each side. Terry Louts, who you just heard, has been connected with Asia and China for most of his life. He was a teenager in Taiwan, served with the U.S. military in Vietnam, earned his doctorate, and has taught and written for decades on U.S.-China mutual perceptions and cultural relations, among other topics. He's a former vice president of the Henry Luce Foundation, which funds this podcast. But that's a coincidence. The reason I'm talking to him here is because he's written a really interesting book about John Birch, the real John Birch.
I stumbled on the name of John Birch, and what got me interested was the fact that he was a missionary and a soldier who spent 5 years in China. I had no idea. I had grown up thinking that John Birch was a right-wing radical who represented the fringe elements in the late 1950s and early 1960s. And I associated him with extremism and had no clue as to who the real John Birch actually was.
So, the real John Birch was born to Baptist missionary parents in India in 1918. Then they moved back to the States, and John Birch grew up mostly in Georgia as the eldest of seven kids. His former schoolmates have described him as smart, maybe a little cocky, firm, perhaps rigid in his religious beliefs. For instance, when he was a student at Mercer University in Macon, Georgia, he and other students accused a professor of blasphemy because he'd suggested the Bible didn't have to be taken literally. There was a trial of sorts at the university. The professor resigned. Birch went on to divinity school, and then in 1940 to China, where he learned fluent Chinese, worked in the sticks, and grew to kind of love the place and its people. And then the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor, the U.S. joined World War II, and John Birch became an intelligence officer, a good one, for a U.S. military unit in China called the Flying Tigers. So I'm going to cut to the chase and just tell you that at the very end of the war, John Birch was shot and killed by Chinese communist troops. There's much more to the story, and I'll get to it. But first, let's hear from Terry Louts about the conspiracy theory around John Birch's death, the one that led Robert Welch, head of the candy company that made pom-poms, to borrow John Birch's name, with his parents' permission, for the new anti-communist society that Welch founded in 1958.
Robert Welch learned about the story of John Birch from a speech that he read in the Congressional Record, which had been delivered by Senator William Noland, Republican from California, actually a prominent senator, prominent politician in his day in the early 1950s. And Noland had stood up on the floor of the U.S. Senate and delivered a speech about a young American soldier who had been killed in cold blood, he claimed, by the Chinese communists. Noland said, if the American people and the American Congress had known about the death of John Birch, that history would have been different. In other words, the American public and the American Congress would have known what to expect from these perfidious Chinese communists.
I mean, it was even more than that, right? Where Noland was saying, John Birch went knowingly to his death to show Americans that the communists really weren't interested in being allies of the United States. They were just using them, and then they were going to advance their evil agenda.
That's right. And, of course, Robert Welch embroidered on the story. But I think it was more than just the idea of an innocent young man who had sacrificed his life so that the world might know what communism was all about. It was a story that in the mind of Robert Welch illustrated the perfidy, illustrated the sabotage, the insidious kind of conspiracy that he believed was going on within the halls of the American government. So Welch, of course, was picking up where Joseph McCarthy had left off with anti-communism and the search for communists anywhere he thought he could find them.
So the conspiracy was that there were communists hidden within the U.S. government, within the senior levels of government, who were actually very sympathetic to these communists.
That's exactly right. And the death of Birch, which both Noland and Welch claimed was a cover-up.
The cover-up idea came from Birch's mother, who had worked hard to get military honors for her dead son. She was initially told by the U.S. military that her son had been killed by stray bullets while riding a train in China. But then, when a military officer visited her home, she read his clipboard upside down, which is quite a useful skill, and saw a different cause of death on the piece of paper on his clipboard. So she was a little suspicious. When Robert Welch formed the John Birch Society 13 years later, he portrayed John Birch as a martyr for liberty, the first casualty of the Cold War, as in this film that the John Birch Society put together.
John Birch commanded no armies, headed no government, converted no nation to his creed. But with his death and in his death, the battle lines were drawn in a struggle from which either humane civilization or godless communism must emerge, with one completely triumphant and the other completely destroyed.
Now, when Birch was killed on August 25, 1945, the atomic bombs had already dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. The U.S. military in China had been fighting on the same side as both the Chinese communists and the Kuomintang, the then ruling nationalist government, against the Japanese. So after John Birch was killed, Mao Zedong met with the commander of the U.S. military in China, General Albert Wiedemeyer, and said he knew nothing about this incident, but if communists had killed John Birch, it was an accident or a misunderstanding, and he, Mao Zedong, was sorry. General Wiedemeyer still dressed Mao down, which didn't do much for U.S.-China relations once Mao came to power. So, what really happened to John Birch? Over to Terry Lautz.
And so he's with a team of Americans, Chinese, and two Koreans, who presumably spoke Japanese, on his way to this north-central city of Suzhou. And he is to investigate the situation there, the condition of the airfield, what's happening with the Japanese who have just surrendered. Is he able to collect any documents? And at this point, also, the communists and the Japanese who have just surrendered and some of the Japanese puppet troops, the Chinese who have been fighting for the Japanese, are engaged in a land grab. All hell is breaking loose. It's chaotic. And the territory that Birch has passed through has been ravaged in this fighting. He's seen telephone or telegraph lines that have been pulled down. The railway tracks have been pulled up. He encounters a village where the communists have done damage. And so he's increasingly alarmed with what's going on because his feeling is the war is over. And he's not happy about this. He's ready to go home, as anybody would have been. He's been in China nonstop for 5 years. He's suffered from malaria. And I think there's good evidence that he was actually suffering from PTSD at this point. So when he encountered a detachment of Chinese communist soldiers who attempted to disarm him, detain and disarm him, he refused, he lost his temper. One thing led to another. He was shot and killed.
And more specifically, he was hurling insults at the communists. He was like, we Americans, we won the war, and now you're trying to disarm us? What are you, a bunch of bandits? And bandits was such a pejorative term, because the Kuomintang used that on the communist guerrillas to say, who are you? You don't have any legitimacy.
That's right. And the investigation of the death, which was quite thorough, because the American high command really wanted to know what had actually happened, determined that Birch at least bore some responsibility for his death because he had provoked the incident. The Chinese communists claimed that they had acted purely in self-defense.
Right, and he actually grabbed the collar of one of the communists and continued to say, you bandits, you're worse than bandits.
I think it was out of character for him to lose his temper in this way. He was very sensitive to the way things got done in Chinese culture. He wrote about this or talked about this in this oral history interview that he did. And so I think he was just at the end of his rope.
So in Chinese culture, losing your temper is this losing face. It's you just don't do that if you want to, you need to be patient and you need to, just kind of see through the situation and find a bonfa, find a way forward. And
yes.
So stepping back from the specifics of what happened on August 25th, 1945, overall, John Birch, who died at age 27, was an idealistic young man. He was very religious. He wanted to be a missionary. He was a missionary for a while before he joined the army. He wanted to continue to spread God's word and convert souls in China and elsewhere. He actually, as he spent time in China, spent those 5 years in China, seemed to develop a more nuanced view of belief. You have more tolerance for people who believe things other than what he believed, and also to see a lot more complexity in China than many of his colleagues did. And so it's high irony that he, in his memory, are invoked by the founders of the John Birch Society.
Right.
On the broader issue of conspiracy theories, how they come up, in the China-U.S. relationship, there have been a lot of them over time, but certainly more of them since 1949.
And I think this is where the loss of China, the unexpected or so-called loss of China, was ripe and ready for a conspiracy theory.
And we're talking about the Communist Party taking over in 1949. That's the liberation from the Communist Party's perspective, the loss from the American perspective.
Right, yes. And this was not something that most Americans saw coming. Americans had invested themselves emotionally through the missionary movement. More American missionaries, men and women, went to China than any other country. The nationalist Chinese government and the American government were allies against Japan during World War II. So there was a strong sense that America could lead the way for China. America could save China for Christianity or for democracy or for capitalism. So when the communists unexpectedly won the war against the nationalists in 1949 and Chiang Kai-shek fled to Taiwan, it was like a political earthquake. And there were those who said, well, this is because of the incompetence of the Truman administration. But there were others who said, there's something more, something deeper going on here. And that is the idea of communists within the U.S. government, within the U.S. State Department, within the U.S. military, who are actually working on behalf of the Chinese and the Soviet communists for the takeover of China and the expansion of communism globally.
Because it couldn't possibly be that the Communist Party won because people supported them, or because the Kuomintang was so corrupt, or because any number of other things happened that just happened.
It was beyond belief.
It struck me as I was reading this section of your book, you know, John Birch went in with a fairly rigid idea. You know, we have the right way of thinking about God and religion and the way to live and Christianity. And there was also another layer of that happening in terms of, you know, we Americans have the right way to govern in terms of democracy, the way that we do it. And there's an interesting parallel between these two different types of rigidity and how they play out in your narrative, and a lack of awareness that there are other ways of thinking, other belief systems in the world. You know, not to say what Mao Zedong ended up doing in power was to be commended, but that it almost seems like the indignation about, you know, how could communists come to power when we were there to help the Chinese walk the correct path, our path. It was kind of arrogant.
I think this missionary complex, this missionary zeal that often works for good in terms of American idealism, American hopes and dreams for others, lives on in reference to China specifically, because I think there's still the hope that the Chinese will become less authoritarian, that they will become more pluralistic in terms of their governance, that the society will open up more to Western liberal values. And this has been encouraged, of course, by China's commitment to modernization, the fact that they've sent so many students and others abroad for education.
More in terms of just, you know, sort of tolerance, recognition of differences, you know, being able to meet someone, a group of people, a country, a culture, where they are, instead of imposing your idea of what they should be on them. It seems like Americans were really not doing so well on those counts during the post-war era. And that, as you know, from having spent time in China, and I have as well, you know, the Chinese see themselves as being the inheritors of a very proud 5,000-year-old culture. And it's like, and who do you think you are coming in and telling us how to act? You know, you could sort of see the friction and the mistrust, the distrust that you say leads to conspiracy theories, and I agree, starting there.
The Chinese, I think, in terms of their own ideology, have long opposed what they called imperialism. They believe that the United States wants to control the East Asia region, wants to control the South China Sea. If you look back to a speech that John Foster Dulles, Secretary of State in the 1950s, gave about peaceful evolution, which was the idea that the United States and the Western powers would not have to fight a war against the Soviet Union and China, but they could gradually influence the change within these states. They could gradually soften and undermine communism. This was something that the Chinese were quite alarmed about, and I think they continue to be deeply concerned about.
Certainly now under Xi Jinping, they're pulling Western textbooks from universities, telling journalists that they shouldn't be writing about these evil or at least problematic Western ideas like democracy, rule of law, constitutionalism, which actually means following your own constitution. you know, that these are dangerous ideas to the Communist Party.
And it's a quandary. It's a puzzle. It's difficult to put all this together because you have so many young Chinese now who have been trained overseas. A lot of the lawyers and judges in China have been trained in the United States or other Western countries. But the Chinese legal system remains essentially a Soviet model. And so you've got that sort of built-in contradiction. But going back to this idea of underlying suspicion, concern about the motives of the United States in particular, because the United States looms very large for China, you can see a very consistent pattern in the way that the Chinese have pointed to the United States as the culprit, as the reason for sabotage dating from June 4th, 1989, or even the Hong Kong umbrella movement in 2014, where the accusation has been made that it's Americans who are behind all of these problems.
Right. And in between, there have been periodic investigations of non-government organizations in China that are getting funding from any U.S. organization, certainly from the National Endowment for Democracy, but others as well. Like, okay, what nefarious intentions do they have? You know, what are you really doing with this money? Are you doing anything that's remotely political? I've seen at least a couple of waves of this, and I think more than that have happened. But how much are you seeing conspiracies that reflect a lack of trust in China coming from the grassroots up as opposed to from the top down and sort of disseminated through state-run media?
That's hard to discern because we don't have very reliable public opinion surveys. You probably have a better sense of that than I do, having reported and having met so many people at the grassroots level.
I mean, certainly a pattern I saw, I think increasingly since the Olympics, was that, and I would say starting with the Tibetan demonstrations in March of 2008, which was the year of the Beijing Olympics, it was just a few months before they happened, something would happen. I would go out and like talk to people about what they thought of it before they'd heard the official take on state-run media. And, you know, there'd actually be a fair, either I don't know, or gee, that's terrible, or something that was really not framed in the way that the government necessarily wanted it framed. I could go out 3 days later after there had been a media barrage, you know, with a particular message, and most people I talked to would be saying something connected to that message.
If a government is able to control the media, it can work one of two ways. Either people, as you were suggesting with the Tibet protests, accept the party line, or if it impacts their own life in a negative way, as it did during the Cultural Revolution, for example, I think people are very likely to believe the opposite of what the government is telling them and to say, well, if the government says A, then B must be the truth.
So I encountered that a lot more in the 90s when I was based in China. I think a turning point, actually, was when the Chinese embassy in Belgrade was hit by a NATO bomb from a U.S. plane. In the first hours before the CCTV news went out at 7 p.m., but people were already hearing a little bit about it, it was just, you know, sort of confusion. What was that about? Then the CCTV news said the U.S. deliberately hit our embassy. And there was intense anger in the streets, I mean, and violence, and throwing Molotov cocktails at the U.S. embassy. But that, for me, was really startling, because up until that point, when I talked to people about some controversial issue where the Chinese government was saying one thing and what was actually happening was a bit different, people would be like, well, you know, I mean, it's the state-run media. What are you going to say? Of course, that's not the case. And it felt like, I mean, it was a little early for the Patriotic Education Campaign to have done its work. That was only 7 years into it. But it felt like people who were old enough to be out in the street already were prepared to think, we're not going to discount the state-run media. They're on our side because this isn't about communism. This isn't about ideology. This is about defending China's honor.
I think to this day, many Chinese believe that this was intentional. There are all kinds of conspiracy theories about why this may have been the case. One had to do with the idea that there were Chinese spies or operators within the embassy who were opposing NATO policy and so on and so forth.
And sending signals intelligence to Serbian forces.
Exactly, yes. Yeah, working for the other side. This, I think, plugs into this deeply held sense of resentment of foreign powers that the Chinese still harbor. They always talk about the 100 years of humiliation, where China was subject to the control or jurisdiction of outside powers. And even though China has become so much stronger economically and militarily, there's still this lingering sense of resentment.
So we're at this interesting moment in U.S.-China relations where I think China's leaders, or at least some of China's leaders, are quick to take offense and quick to see conspiracy in any reaction to China's rise and China's claim of territory and of rights within the world as being a conspiracy to contain China, to keep China down. And in some ways, it sort of harkens back to the 1930s and early 40s, where another rising Asian power felt that it was being unfairly constrained, that European powers and the United States had gone out and expanded their territory and claimed colonies and had a muscular military presence in the world. And why were they trying to hold Japan back? Do you look at the current situation and think that the level of mistrust and resentment and conspiracy theories along these lines are at a dangerous level?
I think we are at an inflection point in the relationship in terms of U.S.-China relations. I think there's growing concern about the direction of Xi Jinping's regime, concern about aggression in the South China Sea, concern about the stability, social stability within Chinese society. It's been described as a smoldering volcano. And it seems to be a result of this incredibly rapid social and economic and political change that we've seen over the last 3 decades and more. We've never seen anything like this before in history. And so the result of this seems to be a society that is not altogether stable. And this seems to be one of the reasons, at least, why the party under Xi Jinping is imposing more control, is trying to root out corruption. And so you have to wonder whether the real problem is internal and domestic, whether China is going to reflect these problems internationally and be a stable player, a stable partner in the world.
It almost seems like they're very much connected, that the Communist Party looks at how it needs to keep delivering something like economic growth or prosperity or something to keep people on side. You've got a population that has certainly appreciated the economic growth over the last 30 years, but they've become better off, better educated, better traveled, more savvy about the ways of the world and what's happening in China versus what's happening elsewhere. There's currently quite a lot of Chinese sending their kids, if they can afford it, sending them to study elsewhere, buying homes elsewhere. A lot of people are sending their money out. And so the government is left with a number of choices of, okay, well, how do we keep people on side? How do we keep our resources here? We need to appeal to nationalism. And I guess for me, a question I actively ask as I look at what's happening in China, especially in recent months, in the last couple of years, is where does this tension end up breaking out? And the way of thinking of, I think, a great majority of Chinese people, which is pragmatic, and, you know, we want a prosperous, stable China, and we don't want a huge amount of control, and we are very proud of our country, but, you know, let's be reasonable here. Does that win out? Or does the party end up succeeding in saying, no, you know, we need to defend our national honor, and so, you know, get behind us and let's do this?
And it's probably a combination of all those things. The overarching question here is whether we're looking at another cycle in terms of Chinese politics or whether this is the new normal. we've always seen ups and downs in terms of the U.S.-China relationship, in terms of tightening and loosening of Chinese internal policies. I think many of us in the United States thought that China was at a point, they had reached a tipping point in terms of not being able to turn back to authoritarian or neo-authoritarian politics. And now we're being proven wrong. And so there are those within the China policy community, the China academic community in the United States who are expressing concern, if not dismay and disappointment. And I find it very interesting, very telling that we're actually using those words because it harkens back to the loss of China in 1949. And obviously we're not repeating history, but I think we have invested so much of our hopes that China will become a different kind of civil society, open to NGOs and foundations, and a society where the liberal values of the students who are returning will be manifested, that the media would become more and more open. There would be more range of opinion, which certainly is the case if you look at the Cultural Revolution or Maoist period as the baseline. It's very important to remember what your baseline is. But I think we are guilty of a certain amount of self-deception or a certain amount of self-delusion, if you will, or hopefulness that China would yet again change in a way that we wanted it to.
But what about it changing in the way that Chinese want it to, which happens to overlap?
I suppose it overlaps for a lot of urban Chinese who are in the new middle class, who understand the value of these freedoms. But I wonder, and here again I would ask you, what you've learned about other people, the majority of Chinese people who did not live in Beijing or Shanghai.
Yeah, I think actually from my experience talking to people in third, fourth, fifth tier cities and in villages, they want that kind of change even more. I mean, they're tired of dealing at close range with abuse of power. And they have dealt at close range with more abuses of power over time. So we've been talking about conspiracy theories that have happened in China over the course of the past 50 years and more, 60, 70. How have you seen the kinds of conspiracy theories that have been developing over time change in terms of what it reflects about the relationship and how people in the U.S. and people in China see each other?
I think Americans are much less worried about communism per se as a conspiracy within the United States. I think that has been put to rest. There is, though, a deep and growing sense of mistrust about China's intentions. Public opinion in the United States has swung from a majority of positive to a majority negative within the last two or three years. And there are a number of familiar issues, trade issues, cyber security issues, human rights. My concern is that this mistrust or distrust could become contagious. It could lead to deeper problems in the relationship. And that then could be the seedbed for a sense that China is not going to rise peacefully, that China has designs that they aren't willing to talk about, that China is really out to control the East Asia and Southeast Asia region, if not the whole world. And so if it goes down that road, I think it'd be very unfortunate and it would be a fundamental misunderstanding within the relationship. And so it's important to remember that we've been there before. We have seen this movie and it didn't turn out very well in terms of Cold War, Korean War, Vietnam War. And so I think we need to do as much as we possibly can to avoid that scenario. The good news is that we are so tightly linked economically, that will serve as a break on this relationship going in a more disastrous direction. We didn't have that with Japan during the lead up to World War II. We have so much more interaction in terms of tourists, museums, the arts, music, you name it. Cultural diplomacy and people-to-people exchanges usually get short shrift when it comes to government discussions, but I think it really deserves more attention than it often receives.
So one last question, and that is just, we've had this history of various conspiracy theories in the U.S.-China relationship, some from the John Birch Society toward the American government, as well as toward China, some from China toward the U.S. government and the U.S. as a nation, and also being concerned about there being sleepers within Chinese society and even within the Chinese government who might be too pro-democracy, too pro-Western values. How, if at all, do you think we can move through this century with fewer conspiracy theories between the U.S. and China?
Conspiracy theories die hard. And as you suggest, the more distrust, the more concern we have about power and the abuse of power, the more it tends to breed the idea of conspiracy. And I think to avoid that is certainly not easy, but all we can do is continue to make the case for a rational, reasonable relationship that's based on the facts.
Terry Lotz, thanks for joining me on Whose Century Is It?
It's a great pleasure to be with you.
Keep it rational and reasonable and based on facts. In this age of Brexit, Trump, and rising nativism, apply that to your political situation of choice. But here's one more thought about conspiracy theories. They're not all wild-eyed nonsense. Many are based on at least a kernel of truth. That's why they stick. For instance, the U.S. government really has promoted a policy of peaceful evolution and really would prefer a China that embraces democracy, human rights, and rule of law. China's leaders really do want to see China project more power in the world and for the United States to graciously step aside and accept that China is this century's new power. There are real differences and real tensions. And even without conspiracy theories, there's a real chance that at some point in this century, those tensions will erupt into conflict. But there's also a good chance that they won't, as long as the leaders of both sides feel they have more to gain from cooperating than from fighting. It helps to understand what matters to each party and where the emotional hair triggers lie that could sweep rational pragmatism off the table and let distrust and conspiracy theories drive decisions. So, what kind of century this will be, whose century it will be, depends in part on how great powers, old and new, navigate this challenge with each other and with their own citizens. That's it for this time. Comments, thoughts, send me a message on Twitter. I'm at Mary Kay Magstad, that's MaryKayMagistad, all one word. If you're not yet subscribing to this podcast, please do. Go to iTunes or most other podcast apps and hit subscribe. And while you're there, if you like the podcast, please leave a review and give us 5 stars. It helps. You can also find the print version of this episode and all 23 previous episodes at pri.org/century. Before I sock out, one more thing. I had the honor and pleasure recently of being a guest on one of my favorite podcasts on China, Seneca Podcast, for its relaunch in New York as part of Sup China at supchina.com. This sharp, funny podcast on China news, views, and culture was started by my friend Kaiser Guo in Beijing a few years back, now with co-host Jeremy Goldcorn, who founded Danwei.org. The three of us, plus another friend, Gadi Epstein, former economist correspondent in Beijing, now its media correspondent, talked about China and the question of whose century is it on a panel in front of a live audience in New York. Check it out. Again, that's at supchina.com, supchina.com. Whose Century Is It is a co-production between me, Mary Kay Magstad, and PRI's The World in cooperation with the BBC World Service and WGBH. It's funded by a grant from the Henry Luce Foundation. Thanks for listening. Join me next time.